What we're going to look at this morning, and I'm going to try, Scott asked me this morning if I was going to do a review, and I said, no, I'm going to do a preview. So I don't want to steal any of Brian's thunder here. But what I want to do is just kind of take a broad brush glance at what we would refer to as the English Reformation, and kind of put things into context, so that next week I think Brian's going to talk a little more in depth about at least the primary initial personality involved with the English Reformation. But before I get started, I read a Desiring God article this week, and I thought it was somewhat apropos to some of the things that we have been talking about and seeing in the Reformation, whether it is in on the English continent or the European continent, or as we look even in England. If I could have three people look up some passages for me, I would appreciate that and have you read them. The first one is Romans 12:16. Who would do that? Okay, Kathy. 1 Peter 3:8. Joab. And 2 Corinthians 13:11. And Lonnie is going to do that one. Okay. So if you got that, Kathy, go ahead.
Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight.
Okay. Joab?
To sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit.
Okay.
Finally, my brothers, rejoice, aim for restoration, comfort one another, agree with one another, and live in peace, and God and the God of love will be with you.
So what was the common theme in those three verses?
Live in harmony.
In harmony, okay. And the article that I read, John Piper pointed out, I think it was John Piper, pointed out that, and in some translations it actually, it translates it one-mindedness. And the idea is that it's not that we should always all agree on everything. I mean, that's not what the scriptures are talking about here. Because obviously, that's going to be an impossible task, is that we should all agree on everything all the time. But the idea here is that we should seek to be in harmony with one another. We should seek to be of one mind or have the same attitude. And if we, you know, if you go to the Philippians passage where it talks about Christ, have the same mind that Christ had, in that he, you know, he humbled himself, right? And so in the context, as we're looking at the Reformation, and we see, you know, the things that have occurred on the European continent with Zwingli and Calvin and Luther, and we see that there was a lot of conflict that developed, not just between them and the Catholic Church, but amongst themselves. And as we begin to look at the English Reformation, we're going to find something very similar there. And I guess my question is, how do we reconcile that? How would we think about that if we were there? What, you know, in light of those three passages, maybe, what would we do? How would we maybe do things differently than say maybe the Reformers did? In an effort to not necessarily unite everybody under one church banner, but how do we learn to live in harmony with one another when we have disagreements, like where Luther believes that infant baptism and what's the term I'm looking
at?
Yes, yeah, there you go, Lonnie. Are legitimate, whereas you know, you have, did we say Zwingli didn't think that that music ought to be a part of the worship service. Or, you know, in Calvin and in the disputes that occurred between them. What? And well, and then I guess we can also, you know, think about Arminius and the dispute that grew up out of, you know, what he developed as his theology. So what do we say today? You know, the Catholic Church lays this accusation against the Protestants, is that, you know, you're all divided. You don't have, you know, one central place where you can go and be united. And yet the scriptures tell us that they'll know, you know, you're my disciples because the love you have for one another and that you're unified. So how do we reconcile that with what we're seeing in the Reformation? Any thoughts?
Well, the Roman Catholic Church does seem united, but it's an organizational unity. It's not necessarily an ideological unity.
Yep.
That's why you have such vastly different doctrines being emphasized, and even people who call themselves Roman Catholic will deviate from just pretty basic Catholic values.
Mm-hmm.
So they can say we have division. They have just as much division. It just doesn't look like it.
Right.
At first glance.
Yeah, definitely. But how do we, as believers today, I mean, looking at, I mean, even if you look across the landscape of Wahoo, and I didn't bother to count them, but how many different churches other than the Roman Catholic Church are there in the town of 5,000 people? There's at least 8, I think, right?
And I've been in smaller towns where there were more churches too, so this is...
Yeah, so this isn't, I mean, this isn't a... And so, you know, do we find that there's animosity between one church or another in this town? I don't know. I don't live in this town. I live in a town that has one church. They used to have two, but they they unified.
Well, Don and I have been talking about this quite a bit because we're coming up at the end of John 17 where Jesus prays that we would be one as he and the Father are one. And that's a difficult thing, and we'll talk about that more in the message next week. But we're talking about the importance of unity and just kind of evaluating ourselves. What have we done that has hindered unity? And we wondered, you know, should we be more willing to talk with people who disagree? And I think if you look at Luther, what if he and Zwingli had continued to talk and taken the time and had patience with one another until they found common ground?
Right. Yeah. And I think that's probably the thing, is that we, and, you know, Scott's mentioned this before, you know, is it important that we're right, or is it important that we align with Scripture? And when we have a disagreement, you know, that's where we go, is we go to the Scripture, and we maintain a conversation. We maintain that dialogue. We don't get angry and walk away and say, I give up. You're just an imbecile, and you'll never understand.
Not to mention that we're all at different places in our walk with Christ.
Exactly.
You're learning something different from me because you're doing devotions in a different place, and it takes a long time for all of us to learn the same things.
Right.
Is it a matter of focus, too? I mean, it seems when there's discussion, like Luther, his focus, there was a line in the sand, and the focus is there. And maybe when you're coming together with someone, the focus should always remain on God and not what we think or what we feel, but what, you know, the joy and the mercy and just the focus.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a good point, yeah.
It's kind of a weird analogy, but in some ways, it's like there's the law, like, and you take this like as a literal thing where, like, Wahoo has civil laws, right? Like, there's criminal laws and civil laws within our own community that are different than other communities. But, like, one police organization and another police organization interpret the laws differently. In so many ways, couldn't you say that's what the church is, too? Like, we didn't decide what the law is, just like the police officer didn't decide what the law is, but you can have different ways of enforcing the law. You know, and so like if two police officers are talking about one law that's been passed, they can interpret it different ways, but it's not like a personal thing. It's like, here's how the law reads. This isn't me attacking you as another police officer. It's us just interpreting the law. But that's the standard that's lost, I think, is it turns into more of a personal thing rather than an objective, here's what the words say, you know.
Yeah, and going back to the scriptures, obviously, and digging into them. And sometimes, you know, issues are not simple. But continuing to have that dialogue and realize that, you know, we have been called to live in harmony, to live in one mindedness with others that would call themselves believers. Now, obviously, that does not include someone who's living a life that is in contradiction to the scriptures. I mean, if there's sin in somebody's life, then there needs to be a confrontation there, and there needs to be a change. But that's not what we're talking about here necessarily. So, anyway, I found this timeline in Wikipedia. And obviously, it's one person's, or whoever put this together, it's their opinion about the significance, they're the significant events regarding the English Reformation. But what I want to do is just spend, and we may not take the whole time this morning, just run through some of the highlights and kind of establish a context here. Like I said, I don't want to steal any of Brian's thunder for next week, but maybe helps establish a context in which he can teach about. And I think you were going to do Henry VIII, right? Which
we might combo this a little bit, yeah.
So, so we start out with a person by the name of Catherine of Aragon. And she marries a person named Arthur, who was actually Henry the VII's son. But Arthur dies relatively quickly after marrying Catherine. And Henry the VII, his wife dies and considers taking Catherine as his wife. But rather than doing that, he allows his son, Henry VIII, to take her as his wife. And then we have the Pope, who confirms the marriage, which, you know, so obviously something that needs to happen in that time frame. And then we move through kind of their life. The whole idea here is that we need to have a successor to the throne. And that's kind of Henry's focus, if you would, throughout all of this. Okay? So, we see that Catherine had a son, but he dies. And she had several children that died. I don't remember how many children she had.
She had six
children, I think. And of all of them, only one of them lived, and that was Mary. Mary will come into play later, so remember that name. Not to be confused with Mary, Queen of Scots. There's two Marys that appear on the scene during the English Reformation, but don't confuse the two. And then just to put this into context, so that was in 1516, Mary is born. In 1517, what happened?
Martin
posts his 95 thesis on the door of the church in Wittenberg, Germany. This says, formally beginning the Protestant Reformation. I would take exception to that because we know Zwingli and Calvin were actually doing things before Martin Luther posted this. But because he actually posted that in a public place and it was taken to the printer and the printer made copies of it and the copies were distributed and it kind of maybe propelled the Reformation, at least in Germany at that point. We'll find out also that there's some significant things here. Anyway, I found this rather interesting. Pope Leo the 10th rewards Henry the 8th for his written attack on Luther by granting him the title of Defender of the Faith. And I don't know, Brian, if you'll go into any of that, but just keep that in the back of your mind, that the Pope and Henry the 8th are obviously in agreement with regard to Luther. In 1524, William Tyndale is expelled from the Catholic Church. What do we know about William Tyndale? Nothing? Come on.
Translator, wasn't he?
Yeah, okay. So if we rewind way back, how about Wycliffe? What do we know about Wycliffe?
He was burned?
No, actually, he wasn't. What did you say? He was a Bible translator. He translated the Bible, but he translated it from the Latin. He did not go back to the original languages. Tyndale, however, that was his... He went back to the original languages, and he was translating it actually from the Greek. But what do we know about languages in the common vernacular and the Catholic Church?
You manipulate it when you translate it.
What's that?
You can manipulate it when you translate it.
And that was their fear, right? And so what, I mean, what was their position on translations?
Latin was the only
one. Yeah, as far as they were concerned, Latin was to be used as the only, and if you wanted to understand the scriptures, you needed to learn Latin. But that's kind of interesting because what is Latin? Is Latin the language of the original text?
No.
No, it's a translation.
And it's not even a very, as far as languages go, some are better, some are worse. It's a very loose language. So you can, whereas Greek is like very precise language. So you can make a lot of mistakes in a loose language.
And what do they call the Latin translation?
The Vulgate.
The Vulgate. Do you know where that comes from? The word vulgar? The word vulgar means common. So the idea that Jerome had when he translated the Bible into Latin was, I'm going to translate it into the common language so people will have it in their language. So it's kind of a contradiction. So originally the version or the language or the translation that they're using was done so that the common people could understand it, but now they don't want the common people to understand it, so they are avoiding... Or they're persecuting those that would try to translate that. And so here we have Tyndale, who is translating the Bible into English, and the Catholic Church is not happy about that. Something to keep in mind: a lot of Tyndale's work was actually the basis for the King James Version, which came under, I believe, James the First, which is in the first part of the 17th century. But in 1525, Thomas Cromwell, and he's a significant personality in Henry VIII's reign, I'll say that, and we'll probably look into him a little bit deeper. But he helps suppress 29 monasteries. That's one of the things that during the English Reformation, most of the monasteries, if not all of the monasteries in England, were disassembled. I mean, they were done away with. Interestingly enough, the New Testament of the Tyndale Bible, the English was actually published in Worms, Germany. And we'll find out later that there are actually people, let's see, jump down to, where did he go? Mm. There's Thomas More Fisher. Where did he go? Well, we'll get to him. A guy by the name of Barnes was executed and accused of, one, smuggling Luther's writings into England, and two, smuggling Tyndale's English Bible into England. And so he was drawn and quartered, I believe, was the...
Robert Barnes,
yes.
He was burned at the stake in July 1540.
Okay. And there's someone right next to him.
Cromwell was beheaded.
Yeah. Thomas Abel. Yeah, okay. He was the one that was drawn and quartered. Anyway. The point of that is that even though we see Henry VIII as being part of the Reformation, we also see that he is very opposed to Lutheran theology. And then we get into, in 1527, Henry VIII expresses his intentions to divorce Catherine. The Pope refuses to grant the annulment or the divorce, which then kind of throws things into a turmoil. And a lot of these other events that you see here are somewhat related to that. I think, and I didn't have time necessarily to research all of them and these individuals. If you like, there is a website on the back page. If you look that up, and then anything that's in blue here, if you click on it, there's a whole lot more detail. I had to turn the lights out on Connie last night because she kept digging into things deeper and deeper. It's like, it's time to go to bed. We can't keep doing this. Anyway. So we see that in 1530, Cromwell becomes a part of the king's council, inner ring. The thing about, and maybe one of the major differences between how the Reformation took place on the European continent and how it took place in England was the fact that England is somewhat isolated because they're an island off the coast of Europe. And so there's a monarchy there that that reigns and reigns in maybe in a little different way than on the continent of Europe. If you think about the history of the continent of Europe, the borders are up to this point are pretty fluid. I mean, they're changing constantly, and there are, you know, emperors or kings that are either aligning with the Pope or they're in disagreement with the Pope. And, you know, there's just all kinds of political things that are going on. And it's somewhat chaotic. But if you go over to England, England is kind of a place unto itself. And when it says Henry makes claims to an imperial title, basically what he's saying is, I am the emperor of this domain. And that kind of drives a little bit of what Henry, of the way he thinks and the decisions that he makes. But anyway, and at that point he's beginning to deny the supremacy of the Pope, and as you see, at the same time, he's encouraging the clergy to not be what's the word I'm looking for here? To not support the Pope, and so you begin to see there's a division there, and there's some things that take place here that that promote that. And then we get down here to Thomas More, resigns as Lord of Chancellor of England. He's Catholic, and he's finding it more and more difficult within the reign of Henry VIII to be Catholic, obviously. It doesn't specify in here, but obviously Henry VIII finds a way to legitimize his divorce of Catherine. And then we'll see that he has other wives. What did we say? He had six wives?
Six wives and several mistresses.
Yeah. Of the six wives, three of them were named Catherine, two of them were named Anne, and one of them was named Jane. I'm yet to figure out why anybody after the third wife would even be interested in being the wife of Henry VIII, because Anne Boleyn was actually beheaded because he was dissatisfied with her. There were some trumped up charges and things. So anyway, Thomas Cranmer is appointed Archbishop of Canterbury in 1533. Once again, Cranmer is another personality that we will probably delve into. As we look through this, you will see that this is more of a political thing, but we can't deny the fact that there were things going on behind the scenes, maybe behind the political scenes, that were actually persons or people, personalities, that were in favor of actually trying to reform the church from a religious or a spiritual perspective. So, and Cranmer would be one of those that we would want to look at and try to understand, what he was doing. Cromwell was more of a political driving force, but he used the religious aspect of it as well to convince Henry VIII to do certain things. But anyway, where was that? John Firth was actually a Catholic priest who was executed. There was a couple other, John Fisher and John Moore were also Catholic, and they were also executed. But like I said, if we get down to, under Henry VIII, there were Catholic priests that were being executed, but there were also those that weren't Catholic but were not necessarily supportive of Henry VIII. They would be considered Protestant, and they were, like I said, they were smuggling Luther's writings, which Henry VIII was very opposed to, as well as Tyndale's Bible, and so they were caught smuggling, they were executed. So we see that there's people on both sides of this issue that Henry doesn't particularly like. We'll go ahead and jump ahead. You can see in 1537, Jane Seymour gives birth to Prince Edward. Significant person, Prince Edward. Let's see, I want to back up. Oh, 1537, Princess Elizabeth is born. So those are basically Henry VIII's three legitimate children. He had other children that were not legitimate and therefore not in line for the throne. So, when Henry dies, which was in 1547. His son assumes the throne at age 9. Okay, Joab, you're the closest to being age 9. Can you remember back when you were age 9? Would you how would you have handled becoming the king of England?
I don't think I would think much of it.
You don't think you'd think much of it? Well, apparently Edward did think much of it, and he took it rather seriously. And basically he began imposing Protestant theology and Protestant practices in England. He only reigned for, I believe, 6 years.
I can't imagine people wanting to listen to him very well either.
You wouldn't think so either, but I'm sure he had, he probably had a substantial list of advisors that, but he was, I mean, he was not raised Catholic. He was raised Protestant up until that age, and so he was, that was, you know, that was his focus. 1553, he dies at age 15. And interestingly enough, he appoints Lady Jane Grey to the throne, which is his cousin, a Protestant cousin. That didn't last very long, because Mary, his half-sister, who was staunchly Catholic, through military means, deposes Jane and eventually has her executed. In 1553, the first statute of repeals nullifies the religious legislations passed under Edward the VI. So in other words, when Mary takes the throne, she reverses everything that Edward had tried to do. And you can see that in a number of those things. We get to 1556, Thomas Cranmer. Cranmer is burned at the stake. I think we read that over 200 Protestant individuals were burned at the stake at the bequest of Queen Mary. And if you've heard the term Bloody Mary, that's who this refers to. And it was because she was rather ruthless in hunting down Protestants and having them executed, especially leaders. But we find that in 1558, Mary dies, and her sister Elizabeth, her half-sister Elizabeth, takes the throne. And once again, she is staunchly Protestant.
So 5 years.
Yeah.
Bloody Mary was the thing.
And sadly, when Elizabeth takes the throne, the reverse begins to happen. She begins to hunt down Catholic priests and have them executed. And, you know, they don't call her Bloody Elizabeth, but from things that I've read is that she actually had almost as many Catholic priests executed as Mary had. It was over a longer period of time.
And usually when you hear the term Elizabethan, it's like a positive connotation.
Yeah.
Not like Bloody Mary, obviously.
Right. But she went a long, long way toward actually reestablishing what Edward, her half-brother, had started in establishing Protestantism in England. It's obviously a different variety of Protestantism because it's not Lutheran. There were a number of people who were influenced by Calvin and Zwingli, and they became professors in some of the prestigious universities in England, like Cambridge and Oxford. And so those those ideas, those theologies were being taught and were being accepted. But I guess the thing that I want us to understand, and I think Brian will bring this out next week and in future lessons, is that a lot of what's happening in England with regard to the Reformation is actually driven by political leaders rather than those like Calvin and Zwingli and Luther, who are coming out of the Catholic Church and, because of their study of the Scriptures, are in disagreement with the Catholic Church. There's obviously political leaders in all of those men's lives that are supportive of what they're doing, but they're not to the extent driving what's happening in the Reformation to the extent that the English crown has done.
It's almost like those other guys had no political origin at all. They obviously influenced politics.
Right.
But all these characters had all their origins in politics, and like the theology was just an afterthought.
And like I mentioned earlier, there were people behind the scenes that were theologically, spiritually motivated in what they were trying to do, but they were also trying to manipulate the political figures to implement what they were trying to do with regard to the reform. Something interesting, and I don't know whether Brian will mention this, but maybe he can expound on it. I've read in more than one place that to the very end, King Henry maintained Catholic theology and Catholic practice to his death. So he never really was not Catholic in that sense, other than I want a divorce and I'm the King of England and I should get what I want, and so I'm going to establish myself. And even today, who is the head of the English church?
It's a monarch.
King Charles.
King Charles the Third? I think it's King Charles the Third. Is it the Third? Yeah. Yeah, I was trying to find him on the internet, find out what his former title was. It's like, I don't know, it's a paragraph. Yeah, Prince of Wales is the first thing, but I guess the Prince of Wales is the person that's in line for the English crown. But anyway, oh, and another thing, just a sidelight here. What's the difference between England, Great Britain, and the United Kingdom? How many people think those are synonymous names? Okay, good. Nobody raised their hand.
England is the smallest.
Okay, England is part of Great Britain, which is part of the United Kingdom. What are the other parts of Great Britain?
Wales and Scotland.
Okay, they're all part of that island. And there's another part of this. In 1587, Mary, Queen of Scots, is executed. There's also something going on in Scotland, and if we take a look at that, they become primarily Presbyterian, which would be under the auspices of which reformer?
Calvin.
Okay. So we see that going on. So Great Britain includes England, Scotland, and Wales. The United Kingdom includes
Northern Ireland
and Great Britain.
Well, and all the dependencies.
Well, yeah. I mean, up until the point when, yeah, Canada and Australia and many of those other places were no longer part of, although there's loose associations even still today with those. I mean, that was...
I think Australia just decided to get rid of the coin with the... Yeah.
Yeah.
So the other interesting thing about the difference between the English Reformation and the others is that I'm not aware of, like, Lutherans having all of these people who are trying to always reform the church in Germany or wherever, or the... Calvinists in Geneva or wherever, but from the beginning of the English Reformation, there have always been people like the Puritans, people like the conservatives. Every single century, you know, in the 19th century, there were conservative priests and pastors, vicars, who wanted to bring it back to a point of the doctrines of grace and that part of the Reformation. Even today, there's more conservative that don't want to go the way of the Church of England as far as the cultural issues and things like that. So I wonder if that's born out of the fact that it was political. So it's almost like the people who were behind the scenes who wanted the Reformation saw the politics as a way to get it, so they kind of glommed onto that, but they never really got what they wanted. They never got true Reformation. So they're always pushing, always pushing.
Right.
Obviously, at least to the Civil War in the 1600s, but yeah.
You see in on the continent of Europe, I mean, there are people who that disagreed with Luther because they wanted a full-fledged break from everything that smacked of Catholicism, and that's not where he wanted to go. Going back to England, it's interesting because you have the Catholics, then you have the Church of England, and then you have the radicals, and by the radicals, we're talking about the Puritans, the Separatists, you know, those people that eventually became the Pilgrims, and so those radicals, and there were some of those on the continent of Europe, but particularly in England, is that because just like Luther didn't want to take and throw everything that was Catholic out the window, neither did the Church of England when it was established. And excuse me. What's the equivalent of, or what's the Church in England, the Church of England called?
Anglican.
It's Anglican Church. What's the equivalent in the United States? Because they're all over the world now. Churches. Episcopal, okay. And that refers to their governing method, whatever. But if you were to go to an Episcopal church, you would find the liturgy to be very similar, I think, to a Lutheran and somewhat to a Catholic church. Okay, so they maintained that, whereas a lot of the radicals and I don't want you to take that as a negative term, but those are the people that wanted true reform. They wanted a separation from everything that smacked of Catholicism, because in their minds, that was the thing that was impeding people from being truly spiritual and having lives that were transformed. And so, back to Scott's point. I mean, there were those, and we see, you know, later on. They were persecuted, so a lot of them fled to the European continent. At some point, actually, some of them came back and went to Ireland, and so that Northern Ireland has some auspices of Protestantism as well. But there's some significant differences in the way the Reformation took place in England as opposed to, you know, how it did in the rest of Europe. And hopefully, you know, we'll get into a lot of the ins and outs of that and trying to understand that, trying to understand some of the personalities and the influences that they had. But, and this is a lot of information, I understand. But, you know, if you have some free time and you just want to learn some things. It was a very tumultuous time in England. I mean, you see, a 5-year period where, you know, a Catholic becomes the queen and is bound determined that she's going to make the country Catholic again. And one of the things as I look through this, I wonder about my own convictions. In that, one, what convictions am I willing to die for? And you think about some of these people and the things that they were willing to die for. But then I thought, on the other hand, what are the convictions that I'm willing to kill for? And you think about, where did they come up with this idea that the best way to deal with somebody that disagrees with me is to terminate them? And you go back to the whole idea of, in Scripture, of one-mindedness, and you see that they've obviously lost that sense of what Christianity is really supposed to be. You know, living at peace, living in harmony, understanding the grace and the forgiveness of our Lord Jesus Christ through His death and resurrection. And even in today's world, I think a lot of us are probably not are old enough to remember when was it the Irish Republican Army and the bombs in England and Ireland that, you know, and they were talking about, you know, the Catholics and the Protestants were fighting each other and killing each other. And where is it in the Middle East? How is that Christianity? And the world looks at that and they go, Christianity is no different than militant Islam. And so just some things that I thought about as I, you know, looked through this and thought about it. And I'm glad I live in the United States of America, where we have freedom of religion. But if you think about this, back in the 1500s in England, there was not freedom of religion. And whose side you were on changed rather rapidly. So it's, what were your convictions? And you wonder about the common people. You know, where were they in all of this, and how did they react? And, you know, King Edward, you know, takes the throne and says, you got to be a Protestant. His sister takes the throne and says, you got to be Catholic. What do I do? How do I respond to that?
If you're Jewish, you're not even in the country.
Probably not. And certainly not any Muslims, right? So, any questions, any thoughts? I mean, I guess we were able to consume the entire time period, but I can talk if I need to. I may not say anything of importance, but I can certainly talk. One of the, and I think, Lonnie, you're going to teach in 2 weeks? Is that the plan? We talked about the radicals in England. I mean, Lonnie's going to bring up some radicals that, you know, and what, you know, what transpired when you disagree with those who have more power than you, you know, what happens to you, even though you might be right. So, anyway, hope I didn't steal.
No. It was good for me, too. I'd only done preliminary stuff. I wasn't even...
Okay.
I mean, I took more away from this than what I've already done, so...
Well, you certainly can go to that website, yeah. And there's all kinds of articles if you want.
That's right.
And obviously, I mean, it just... It depends on the person who's doing the documentary or doing the article. Connie and I watched a documentary a few weeks ago on Henry VIII, and... you could tell that there was a certain bent toward their approach to it. Just keep that in mind if you do read articles. try to keep it in perspective and understand that, you know, there's obviously a perspective that the author is coming from when they write. But so if there's no other questions, we can I'll close in prayer.